Hello, this is Mort Fertel. Welcome to the audio CD program called That's What I Was Going to Ask. Answers to the most common and crucial questions about fixing your marriage. This is CD 1. Periodically, I conduct live Q&A teleconferences when I answer people's questions and offer advice about how to handle their situations. This audio CD program is a collection of the most common and crucial questions asked by participants from those teleconferences. As you listen to the CDs, sometimes you'll hear the participant's voice asking the question. Other times I'm reading a question that was emailed to me in advance of the teleconference. In either case, my response follows. Okay, let's dive into the first question.
This is Patty.
Hi, Patty. First of all, my apologies to the other women who are trying to get in. We'll get you. We'll get you.
We all want a piece of you.
Hang in there.
My husband left me 18 months ago after an unusually explosive argument. We've had arguments and stuff, but we've always been a very open, loving, affectionate couple. People have always commented on it. We used to do all those things, date night, touch, talk, everything. And it was like a month before his 39th birthday. Just 13-year age difference. I'm older than he is. And he met this 24-year-old girl. He became friends with her, and I felt him pulling away. But he says it has nothing to do with her. It's me and all my old baggage, my jealousies, my distrust. He's had a couple of affairs before. In the last 18 months, I ended up in severe depression with some counseling, got myself straightened out, dealt with all my old issues. He talks to me daily online. It's like he cannot go without chatting with me. He pays for everything because I'm not able to work. I had a car accident in December, which he took care of me through. I mean, he does everything a husband does, except be here, live here, make love to me, you know, that stuff. I mean, he says he loves me, always will love me, will always take care of me, worries about me, but he can't see us getting back together again. He says he's afraid that we will just go back to our old things. He doesn't trust me enough, I guess, that things could be different. I don't know how to get through to him.
Okay.
I'm sending him all the emails I got from you.
Right. Okay, so
commented on them.
So I'm going to your question is very general. Now there's about a million different ways that I could answer this question, and it would take hours and hours and hours. It's okay. This is not a critique of your question at all. I'm just giving a precursor to my answer. So it's a general question. There's a million different ways I'm going to answer it. I'm going to choose to answer it in one particular way right now, which I think is a good start as an answer to your question. And I also am choosing this answer because I think it'll be incredibly relevant for almost everybody else listening on the line. But I just want to say in advance, Patty, that this is by far not the whole answer to your question. And you can feel free to ask me the same question another time, and I'll answer it a different way and just give you more direction and more insight, okay?
Okay.
So I just felt that it was important to preempt my answer with that because I don't want you to feel that I missed your question. I want to offer some things, you know, other than to respond with just as general an answer, I want to give you something specific. But, of course, the downside of something specific is that it's specific and it doesn't hit everything. But it's a piece of a puzzle which I hope to fill in for you more over the next 7 weeks, okay?
Okay.
Okay. So this isn't particularly relevant. Patty's in the Lone Ranger track, and this is particularly relevant for everybody in the Lone Ranger track. But as those of you on the Duo track will learn, this is also very relevant for your situations as well. Because Patty's question is basically, if I could just translate it into different language, is how do I get through to my husband? Or how do I get him to change? And of course, that's a question that's on all of our minds. How do I get my spouse to change? Listen carefully. Your spouse will change at one time and one time only, when they decide. Not 1 second before. And the more you push them, prod them, convince them, manipulate them, control them, scream at them, throw plates at them, threaten them, serve them, or any other way, shape, or form that you try to get what you want, the less likely it will be that they will change. Now, hear carefully what I said. I didn't just say that your efforts would be ineffective. That would be neutral. What I said was that your efforts would be counterproductive, meaning that the more you try to get them to change, to be and to do what you want them to do, the less likely it will be that they will do it. It will actually inhibit the very objective you're trying to achieve. Why? Because in spite of the way it may feel in your situation, people will change. People do change. Believe me, I'm in the business of people changing. I see it every day. But people will change only and when it's their idea. They want it to be their idea. And as long as it's your idea, then you're actually in the way of it being their idea. Meaning, as long as it's your idea, then you're interfering with what has to happen in order for them to change, which is, it's got to be their idea. And so, you actually have to vacate that position. You've got to get out of the way and make available to them that decision-making position. Because as long as you're taking that position, as long as that's what you want for them, well then by definition, in a marital situation that's at where almost all of yours is at, whatever position you take, you can bet your spouse will take the opposite position. If you say black, he'll say white. If you say right, he'll say left. If you say it's wrong, he'll say it's right. It doesn't really matter what he thinks. He's not even thinking. He's just thinking, what does she think? And I'm going to be sure to take the opposite position. It's just the psychodynamics of the deterioration of a relationship. It's the way people work. It becomes an issue of control. And so the most important thing you can do is to relinquish that position, to have it no longer be your idea, so that it can become their idea. And if you clear the way, if you make the space for it to be them, their idea, now at least there is the opportunity for them to come in and to occupy that position. It's kind of like if you've ever tried to go through a door and you can't get through the door, you push on the door, it just won't open. And then you realize, oh, duh, the door opens towards you. It's kind of like that in your marriage. The more you push on the door, the tighter it closes. And if you want that door to open, you actually have to step back, step away, back off. And now the door can swing open and the other person can come through. And that's exactly the way it works with relationships and marriages that have deteriorated. Is you've got to step back. You have to back off and give your spouse the opportunity, the space, to step into that idea, that place that you want him or her to occupy. Now, this is hard because most people feel that, well, then what do I do? I'll basically resign myself to being passive. I just simply do nothing. I'll feel so useless. I'll feel so inactive. I'll feel like I'm just sitting around and being beat up and I'm not doing anything about it. Well, as you'll hear in a second, there is something you can do about it. I'll get back to that in a second. But first, I just want you to understand that it's not that you're doing nothing. You're actually doing the most important thing you could be doing, and the most proactive thing you could do is to get out of the way. And by the way, that takes a very proactive person to do it, because it's very hard. Your impulse, a person's impulse, is to be proactive and to try to initiate and effectuate another person's change. But sometimes that's not the best thing you can do. Sometimes the best thing you can do, the most proactive thing you can do, is to step away. And sometimes being passive is actually the way to create the most activity. And so the first key, the first step to really getting a person to change is to get out of their way, to give them the opportunity to make it their idea. And after all, like I said, there's really nothing you can do. I shouldn't say nothing. There's one important thing you can do, which I'll get to in a second. But, you know, you can't make somebody change. You know, a person, it's going to be their decision. It's going to be their idea. And so as soon as you understand that it's their decision and it's their idea, then there really is only one remaining important question. And it's a crucial question. And it's really where you've got to turn your attention to. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay, and it's not just for you, Betty, but I'm glad you're ready. The question is, for everybody, what's your fixing? You're fixing. I know your spouse is fixing. I know all the mistakes they made. I know all the sins they, that you've confessed for them. I know all the problems they have and the flaws they have and all the reasons why everything is their fault and how everything would be different if they would only do X, Y, Z, and A, B, C. And I'm not saying you're wrong, by the way. You probably know your spouse better than anybody, and I'm sure that the list you could make of their flaws, their problems, and the things you want them to change, I bet they're accurate. I bet it's true. And I hope your spouse comes to that realization as well. But it's not relevant. At least to you, it's not relevant. It's relevant to him or to her, whoever your spouse is, but it's not relevant to you. Because there's nothing you can do about it. That's his work or her work. That's his fixing or her fixing. The question for you, the relevant question for you, is what is your fixing? What's your role? What's your responsibility in the deterioration of this marriage? Why did she run off with another man? Why is he constantly going to the bottle instead of to your arms? Why, you fill in the blank. But in a family, in a marriage, there's not two individuals. There's a system. There's a marital system. There's two people that are feeding off of each other, that are interconnected. We're going to talk more about this in week 4 of the boot camp. There's two people that are interconnected, and what you do impacts what he does, and what he does impacts what you do, and everybody's interconnected and affecting each other. There's a great story, actually, of this man comes to a local town because he's thinking about moving to this town. And so he finds the local sage. He says to the sage, I'm thinking about moving to this town. Tell me, what are the people like here? So the sage says to him, well, what are the people like where you come from? So he says, oh, where I come from. He says, the people are mean-spirited, angry, miserable, and cruel people. So the sage says to the guy, well, people are pretty much the same here. So about a month later, another guy comes to town. He's thinking about moving here. He goes to the local sage. He says, excuse me, but I'm thinking about moving here. What are the people like here? So the sage says, well, what are the people like where you come from? So the guy responds, oh, where I come from, he says, the people are wonderful, kind, generous, compassionate, very loving. So the sage says, well, people are pretty much the same here. It's a very powerful story with a very profound point, which is that people are not so much as you see them. They are as you are. In life, we experience much what we put out is what we get back. And whatever it is we put out very much affects what we get back. And after all, the greatest thing we can do to impact change in our life for the people around us is to be a model. It's to be a shining example. It's to be a tower of moral authority. And so on the one hand, a few minutes ago, I said to you, look, there's really nothing you can do to change another person. The decision's got to come from them. But now I'm changing my tune a little bit, and I'm saying the most important thing you can do to affect the behavior of another person is to change yourself. And if you think about it, it's the people around us in our life that have the greatest impact upon us. And it's our model, it's our example, it's our life that impacts those around us. There's a great teaching, short but great, that you'll hear me say periodically, which is, say little, do much. Say little, do much. In the words of Ralph Waldo Emerson, who you are speaks so loudly, I can't hear a word you're saying. So all the crying and complaining and begging and pleading and arguing, they're all words. What is the life that you're leading that's behind it? That's really the question. Let's take, for example, a personality like Mahatma Gandhi. I mean, this, of course, is an unusual personality in life, but you know what? If he can do it, we can do it. I really believe that. And what did he do? I mean, here's a man who never held a knife in his hand or a gun in his pocket. And yet he brought the most powerful nation in the world to its knees. How did he do that? Really? It's a phenomenal story. But it's true. And how did he do it? He had one simple secret. He did it through his life. The way he lived inspired and impacted so many people that it changed the nation and brought another nation to its knees. Years before, he said, one day you will all just put down your weapons and walk out. And they laughed. And it happened exactly the way he said it would. And it was just through his example that he inspired it. And I believe that if Mahatma Gandhi can change the lives of hundreds of millions of people and bring the most powerful nation in the world to its knees, we can influence the few people in our family. Now, I know some of you probably thinking, Mort, you haven't met my husband. He's harder to change than 350 million people. Okay, could be. And I understand some of your situations are very difficult and you're dealing with some very obstinate and stubborn people. Nonetheless, the teaching holds true. The most relevant, the only relevant question for you is what you're fixing and to go to work on it day in and day out. And what's your, and I'm sorry, what?
Well, last year I asked him for a list of what I needed to fix with me. And he supplied me with a list and he was correct on each and every one of them. And that's exactly what I have done in the past year is I have fixed all of the issues except for my not trusting him. I mean, he's had a couple of affairs. It's kind of hard to work on that by myself. You know? And I just... He seems to be perfectly comfortable with the way things are now. He can have his me during the day and chat with and everything, but not be here. You know? And it's very frustrating and confusing stuff.
Right.
But he doesn't know I'm doing this.
How long has this been going on, by the way?
He left me 18 months ago.
How long has he been with this other woman?
Well, he says that they're not romantically involved, that they're just really good friends, but she is his roommate and has been for like 4 months.
Uh-huh.
They live in a two-bedroom apartment. He says he has her room, she has her room. I don't know. I've never been there. I've asked him to go out for lunch. I've asked him to do different things with me, and I get, I'll see. He's perfectly comfortable to come here and do things with me here. He comes over to see our son, but he spends most of the time chit-chatting away with me, having coffee and talking and, you know, being nice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, without talking about issues or anything. He talks about work, he talks about this and everything else. I mean, we have a very good relationship in that way, except I have asked him about working on our relationship, trying to be our marriage, and I don't see it happening.
Right. Well, let me just let me point out something that I sense that is going on. And of course, we're only speaking for a few minutes, Patty. So you know, if I'm off, you let me know. But it sounds to me, just from your description, that the nice that you're being with each other and the conversation you're having with each other is doesn't sound all that different than the conversation you might have at the hair salon.
Yeah.
Right. So that's not really doing much to renew a marriage. That sounds like successful co-parenting.
And I don't know how to do anything else with him if I... He has this wall up.
Well, do you have a wall up?
No. I'm a very open person. I don't hide things. I'm an emotional person. Hmm. I don't know how to build a wall like that. I'm just too open for that, and he knows my feelings.
Can you give me an example of how you've been open? Give me an example of a conversation you've had with him recently that is reflective of your openness.
Well,
because what you've described to me was the kind of openness that you would see in a hair salon.
Well, because he won't let me talk about anything else. We talk about work, or we talk about the house, or we talk about the bills, or we talk about our 18-year-old son.
What do you mean he won't let you?
He turns me off. You know, it's like, I don't want to talk about it. There's nothing left to talk about.
No.
I've been through this.
He's referring to, I assume he's referring to conversations about your marriage.
Right.
Yeah, no. That's not the topic that you want to bring up right now.
And what do we talk about? I mean, other than work and the bills and the house.
What else is there in your life?
I'm trying to start a business, which he is fully supportive of. We talk about that.
Mm-hmm. What do you talk about regarding the business?
You know, how I'm going to sell what I'm making, how I'm working on it, how to do, you know, set up the business. He's been very helpful in setting up my computer for that. And
it's all very practical, logistical,
yeah,
and things you would discuss at the hair salon. Tell me something. I want you to share with him something you would only share with him. Are you scared to lose the money that you're investing in this business?
No, because he's the one that's giving me the money. I mean, he pays for everything.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a dream that this business would become something, a legacy for your children? Do you understand my point? You don't have to answer these questions. I'm trying to get you to go to a certain inner place within you and to go there with him in a way that you wouldn't go with somebody at the hair salon. Because so far, all the conversations you're describing to me are they're fine. They're not negative, but they're conversations that are on the level that he wants the relationship on. If you want to transform the relationship into something more than co-parenting, then you've got to start to have conversations with him that are reflective of conversations between people that are intimate. Now, one topic that's off limits right now in his mind, which I understand and you need to respect, is the marriage. He's going to put the wall up as soon as he feels that the topic is reconciling. That's not what he wants to talk about.
No.
Okay, but what you've got to do is give him the feeling and the experience of intimacy with you before you actually talk about intimacy with you. You don't ever really have to talk about it. Just do it.
But I don't know. I'm lost. I don't know what to say to him outside of what we talk about, because he seems to turn me out. You know what I'm saying?
Not really. Tell me about your 18-year-old son.
He's ADHD. He's been depressed for the last year and a half. I wonder why. Found out he's bipolar a couple weeks ago.
How does that make you feel?
Worried.
What are you worried about?
His future.
What do you think might happen to him?
That he won't be focused. He won't he's very smart. And this is his dad. I don't know how to help him.
Now you got it, Betty. That's the place. That's the place.
I'm going to talk to him about that.
It's just an example. It's not the topic. It's the place you went to that you would only go with someone special. Okay, so like I said, that there was nothing magical about that topic. But what was magical was the place that you went with it. And there's probably a lot of topics in your life. And that, by the way, doesn't mean that you have to cry. But a tear is a sign of an emotion. It's a sign of an inner place that you are, that is intimate. You could also have a similar, a similar experience, a conversation with somebody that's more joyful or proud. You know, there's a certain pride or sense of accomplishment that we might express to somebody like our spouse that we wouldn't feel comfortable expressing to somebody else.
Okay.
So I do think what you've told me, you do have to be careful with the topic, because if he's going to end up feeling guilty, responsible, or this has relates to do with him, so he's not ready for that now. It's clear to me. And so I don't want you to get stuck on the subject. It doesn't have to be your son, although it could be. But I just wanted to give you an experience, an example of a non-logistical inner place that you can go and you can share with him. Now, also be realistic. I don't want you to think that, you know, you're going to shed one tear with him. He's going to come running back into your arms.
No,
you know,
that
it's
happened already.
Right. I mean, it's about building a relationship. You know, and that takes time.
It's getting him over his fear of things returning to where they were. That's what he says. He's afraid that things will just go back to the way they were. He doesn't trust it.
Okay, so we'll need to talk about, I'm going to move on at this point, because
right.
I feel like we've accomplished something significant, and I'm going to give you a chance to chew on that. But next week, we can go on to, you know, what that fear is about, where was that place, have you dealt with those issues, and even if you have, why does he feel like those issues weren't dealt with? And there's lots of, you know, there's lots of reasons why that might be the case.
So let's summarize and elaborate just a little bit further. The most relevant question for you in this situation is, what's your fixing? I know your spouse has all these issues and problems. You could make me a huge list. All the reasons why they're a creep. She's a this and he's a that, and they got to change this and they have to change that. And I'm not saying you're wrong. You're probably correct that your spouse has lots of work to do and is at fault in many ways. Let me just give that to you. You're correct. But now let's move on to something relevant for you. What's your fixing? In other words, you could be correct, but it's completely irrelevant to you because there's nothing you can do about it. And so you're wasting your time and energy trying to get them to make changes, because people change when it's their idea and when they want to change. And so it's not that you're wrong. You probably have a better assessment of your spouse's flaws and issues and changes they need to make than anybody. But you're wasting your time and energy. And the question is, what is your fixing? And when you begin to go to work on the changes that you have to make, that is the most significant thing you can do in order to inspire your spouse to make the changes that you want them to make. Because all of a sudden, they will begin to see you transforming as a person and as a spouse. Wow, what's going on there? You want to get their attention? Screaming, asking, complaining, all that stuff, pleading with them to try to go to counseling and to join the boot camp and this and that, that's not going to get their attention. They're used to it. They're going to run the other way. They don't want to hear it. You want to know what will get their attention? You become the kind of person and the kind of spouse that anybody in the world would want to be with. That'll get their attention. You know, it's kind of like being a gourmet chef. What's a gourmet chef do? A gourmet chef, he doesn't ask you to eat the food, and he certainly doesn't force you to eat it. But what he does is he prepares it in such a way that it looks delicious and it smells delicious. And so when the gourmet chef puts it out on the table, you look at that and you say, wow, give me a bite. Let me dig in. And that's what you need to do. You need to be like a gourmet chef and sort of prepare yourself and the marital environment in whatever way you can control it to be so appetizing that they will just want a bite. And that's the only way it's going to happen. And it's very hard because most people, a lot of people in these situations, they want to talk about their spouse. They want to point the finger. And again, you might be right. But I've never seen a marital situation where there's not dual responsibility. There's a reason why you picked this man. There's a reason why you picked this woman. And there's something about the way you're interacting with this man and this woman because of who you are that is creating these circumstances. What is it? What's your fixing? Put it another way, I want you to become the husband that 3 billion women in the world would want to be with. And at that point, I guarantee you, you'll have your wife back. But that's not about what she's got to do. That's about what you've got to do. And that's hard. But we can help you.
What is the difference between a marriage coaching session and marriage, traditional marriage counseling? What would be the difference?
Okay, Teresa asked, what's the difference between marriage coaching and traditional marriage therapy or counseling? Excellent question. It really strikes at the root of the difference between marriage fitness and most other approaches to marriage success. I'm going to speak in generalizations. The definition of a generalization is that it's generally true. This is not true for every counselor and every therapist. Different people have different approaches and have been trained in different schools. But generally, when you go to therapy or marriage counseling, there's a couple of things that are going to go on there. First of all, they're going to very quickly ask, inquire, and begin to deal with your marriage problems and your issues. Not only are they going to deal with your marriage problems and your issues, but they're going to start digging at the root of those problems and issues, which tend to be your parents, your mom, your dad, your childhood, their marriage. So essentially, they're going to double the problems. The first step in the marriage fitness approach is really the exact opposite. The only time or the only energy that I would put into discussing your problems or issues in a marriage coaching session is simply so we could succeed in putting them aside. You know, I did my 10-minute marriage coaching session with one of the teleboot camp participants last night, and this question came up because they wanted to know, they're in counseling, should we continue counseling? I answered them in a similar way to the way that I answered Chuck on Monday night, which is that if your counselor is in the traditional mode of dealing with your problems and your issues, and if those problems and issues are throwing you into this negative tailspin and making you feel even worse when you come out than when you went in, and if you feel that the marital environment that you're existing in is not strong enough and not healthy enough and doesn't have enough positive energy yet to deal with these problems, these issues, and this weighed down stuff, then I don't believe that traditional counseling and therapy is a healthy thing for a lot of people at a certain time. Now, again, if your relationship, you know, if you turned it around, if you succeeded in building some goodwill, building the emotional bank account, changing the energy and the environment in your house, the relationship is on the upturn, things are going well, you've succeeded in implementing a number of positive relationship habits, and you have momentum, So now you can go back to those problems and those issues and deal with them. And in fact, therapy or a counselor might be the best place for you to do that. It's a question of timing. And in my opinion, in most cases, the timing that therapists and counselors recommend is off. And that very often is the problem. Marriage coaching, essentially, I would coach you through exactly what I just described. The only discussion about problems and issues that there would be is discussion that would help us succeed to moving them aside, getting them out of the way. Sometimes there are actually clients fly me into wherever it is they're located, and I have these full-day intensive sessions with the wife and then the husband and then both of them together. And sometimes that whole first day can be all about getting those problems out of the way. In a nutshell, Teresa, marriage coaching is not about the past, it's about the future. Somebody emailed me this week the following question, which I'm going to try to answer. I'm neither in love with nor attracted to my spouse anymore. I think I can have a passionate relationship with John Smith. I changed the name, of course. Should I end my marriage and move on? Or is there hope for us somewhere? Okay, this is an excellent question. And I want to use the opportunity to speak about the natural cycle of relationships as a very important subject matter to understand. Because every relationship has a natural cycle. Everyone. And it goes something like this. So first, we meet and we fall in love. And that falling in love is a spontaneous, natural experience. It's euphoric. It's unbelievable, right? I mean, it's what poets have been writing about for thousands of years. It's what Hollywood tries to capture on the screen. It's really one of the experiences that drives so much of our behavior and our actions and our motivations in our life. We fall in love. But that falling in love, as I said, is a spontaneous and natural experience. We don't actually do anything to make it happen. That's why it's called falling in love. Because we're out of control. It's happening to us. Sometimes a woman will say, I was swept off my feet. Think of the imagery of that. She's standing there doing absolutely nothing, and something came along and moved her. Something happened to her. And that is the experience of love. But then, after a few years, inevitably, it's natural. It happens to every relationship. That euphoric experience begins to fade. And when it does fade, when it does change, it's important that you know and that you realize that there's nothing that happened that's unique to your relationship. There's nothing wrong with your relationship. There's nothing wrong with your spouse. You see, so often at that stage of the game, people start thinking and looking at each other and saying, hey, something's wrong here. I married the wrong person. And they start wondering, well, how about that guy at work, John Smith? I think I could have a pretty exciting, passionate marriage with him. It could work there. And they start wondering, did I marry the right person? But see, the key to succeeding in marriage is not finding the right person. It's learning to love the person that you found. Because regardless of who you find, the natural cycle of a relationship will take its course. And to some extent, the problem with understanding this is to some extent the person that looks up after a few years and says, hey, John Smith at work is pretty cool. I think I could really get along with him and fall in love with him and have that euphoric experience that we're all yearning to have. The problem is they're right. They probably could fall in love with him, and they probably could have that euphoric experience with John Smith. But 2 to 3 years later, they'd find themselves in exactly the same position with John Smith. Because once again, the key to succeeding is not finding the right person, but it's learning to love the person that you found. And that's why we have the expression, the labor of love. Because it takes work, it takes time, it takes energy, and most importantly, it takes wisdom. You have to know what to do in order to recreate that experience that you once had. Because as I said in the beginning, you didn't really have to know anything. You hardly had to do anything. It's natural. It's spontaneous. It's a gift. But that gift gets taken away. It's just the way the world works. I didn't make it that way. It's just the way it works. That's the laws of love, so to speak. And then what you have to do at that point, if you really want lasting, I mean, if you want to skip from relationship to relationship for your whole life, you know, fantasizing about having that euphoric experience and having it with a number of different people, so you could do that, but I don't think that's very fulfilling. You'll never find lasting love, and at the end of your life, you won't know whose eyes you're looking into, and your kids will be with somebody else, and, it'll be a mess. But if you want to maintain that fabulous experience that you once had, then you have to, A, learn how to create it, and it is creatable. You can create it. I'll talk about that in a second. And B, is you have to have the systems and the structure in your life and the discipline to implement those things. And then if you do them consistently, you can manufacture, so to speak, or make love. But it takes time, it takes energy, and it takes wisdom. But you can do it. There are laws of love, just like there are laws of the universe. You know how we have gravity, and it's a law of the universe. You can't beat it. You could beat yourself against it, but you can't beat it. It just is. You have to find a way to work within it. And just like the right diet and exercise makes you physically healthy, so too doing the right things with your spouse will make your marriage healthy. It's a simple cause and effect, kind of like cooking with a recipe. If you follow the steps, so it works. Okay, in a safe and secure marriage, should there be any secrets from one another? Should all time, money, and energy spent be known by the other spouse? Or is this smothering and deadly? Finally, how do we move from no trust to trust? All right, so there's really two different questions here. In a safe and secure marriage, should there be any secrets from one another? Should all time, money, and energy spent be known by the other spouse, or is this smothering and deadly? You know, in the last teleboot camp, we had a couple who he had had an affair, and he came clean with his wife, told her about it, and they were trying to reconcile their marriage. He was trying to minimize his contact with this woman in order to try to renew things with his wife, but he was struggling with that because they worked together. She was always at his environment, and the truth is that he was struggling with his feelings for her. That obviously was a great challenge for his wife, knowing that he had these feelings for her, and they were in counseling. And apparently this counselor recommended that, you know, hey, honesty is the best policy. And part of the healing that you guys have to go through is you need to, let's call him Joe, change the name, but Joe, you need to share with, change the name, Nancy, how you're feeling about the woman you had an affair with, Rachel. In other words, share with her the struggle that you're having and where you're at in that process. So Joe was sharing with his wife his feelings for this other woman after this affair while they're trying to reconcile their marriage. And it's tearing her up inside. And he's describing this to me during one of the Q&As, and I said, wait a second. Why in the world are you sharing your feelings about this woman you had an affair with your wife? Well, that's what my counselor recommended. Honesty is the best policy. I said, that's not honest. That's stupid. That is a very unsophisticated approach to the truth. Because there is a greater truth than the literal meaning of being honest sometimes. On your wedding day, when your bride looked completely different than you've ever seen her before, because, brides, they get their hair done by somebody new, and they wear makeup they never wore, and whatever. It's just a whole different look. Now, sometimes I think these brides don't look better. They sometimes, I think, look worse. But what, is honesty the best policy? Should you tell your bride on her wedding day that, you know, what did you do that for? It doesn't look so good. That's not honest. That's stupid. You tell her she looks beautiful. And it's not a lie. It's the truth with a capital T. It's more honest. Because it's more honest about your relationship with them and your sensitivities to issues beyond the literal meaning of honesty. And so, should there be any secrets in a marriage? Well, it really depends on what you mean by a secret. It depends on why you're not telling them the secret. I actually did an interview with Red Book Magazine a little while ago, and the interviewer and I kind of came to, well, then how do you really know where to draw that line? And I had never really thought about it, but she was challenging me, and we realized together that you know how you know where to draw the line? You have to think about why you're saying what you're saying, why you might be telling a little white lie. If you're telling a little white lie for yourself, to protect yourself, to not embarrass yourself, or to secure yourself, or for any reason whatsoever for yourself, then you shouldn't do it. That's the wrong reason. It would be the wrong move. That would be a lie. But if you're holding a secret out of sensitivity for your spouse, it might be okay. Next question. I'm going to be driving tonight while listening to the Q&A, and I did not want to have the background noise disrupt the session, so I'm passing along my question via email. We had talked a bit during our 10-minute session earlier this week, and you had recommended that I post my question for tonight. Basically, my question is in regard to a lack of trust my wife has in me in our marriage, a lack of trust. I have made a terrible mistake and cheated on my wife by frequenting adult clubs with work friends about once a month for the last year, and actually went on a date with a dancer that I had met. While I did not cross the line in having sex, and did break off contact with the dancer before my wife discovered what was going on, I have greatly betrayed my wife and her trust. Our marriage was not the best for the last 4 to 5 years leading up to this, but it has forced things overall, and now I am really afraid of losing the person I love and a great family. My question is, how can I regain my wife's trust and get our relationship to the point that my wife can forgive me and look to go forward in trying to fix our marriage? We are currently decent roommates and manage household tasks and the kids well, but our marriage is non-existent and she is contemplating divorce. I want to be proactive with the talk charges, touch charges, date nights, etc., but I know she will be hesitant. What can I do? Okay. So this is a question that I imagine everybody has. It's a question about trust. If a marriage has problems, which all of yours do, chances are very good that in some way the trust has been broken. And yet trust is central for a successful marriage. So how do you restore broken trust? You know, trust can be broken between two people in so many ways. The most common is an affair. Here, this gentleman frequented strip clubs. Sometimes people have hidden addictions. Porn sites are the newest problem. Lying, financial secrecy. I mean, there's all types of things that can break trust between two people. But if you look deep into the heart of a distrusting spouse, it really goes beyond the usual trust busters, let's say. Trust is weakened in a relationship when a spouse is late, unreliable, insensitive, hiding a few empty beer cans or a receipt can damage trust between a husband and wife. It really doesn't take much to destroy trust. It doesn't have to be a huge dramatic event. It can take a little thing to deteriorate it. But it sure takes a lot to rebuild it. Let's face it, we live in a microwave world. Fast food, express delivery, speedy print. And so we figure, okay, if we lost trust in an instant, so then there must be some way to rebuild it quickly too. Well, sorry to break the news to you,
but it can't happen quickly. Trust can only be built one small step at a time. There's no other way. There's no Herculean event that can deliver instant trust. In fact, by definition, trust is about, are you ready? Consistency. That's what it means to trust somebody, to be able to predict their behavior. When they go out and they're not coming back till 11 o'clock, you know where they are and you know that they'll be back by 11. Predictability is a function of repetition, and repetition takes time. Think about it. When you trust somebody, it means you can rely on them. But before you can rely on someone, you have to depend on them time and time again and not be disappointed. If you're disappointed even once, then the trust is broken. I mean, think about our relationship. I mean, the relationship between me and you. A number of weeks ago, you signed up for the Marriage Fitness Teleboot Camp. At that point, the only contact you probably had with me was through my emails. Now, you get lots of emails from lots of people. Who am I? At some point, somehow you had enough confidence or trust to actually take out your credit card and register for the Marriage Fitness Teleboot Camp and get help. But the chances are still good that you were hesitant or unsure as to whether or not I would come through. Now, at this point, this is our fourth teleconference that I've scheduled for 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on a particular night. The schedule is on the members-only website. The first time you checked the schedule, you called in, you were probably wondering whether or not this guy is going to pick up. Is he reliable? Will he be there? Or did he just take my money and he's going to run? Ah, there I was at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Okay, I feel a little bit better. Now, the second time, you probably were expecting more that I would be there. And in fact, I was. Now, when you called in tonight for this teleconference, this is the fourth time. I doubt you had much doubt about whether or not my voice would come over at 9 o'clock and say, well, welcome back to the Marriage Fitness Teleboot Camp with Mort Fertel. And if I tell you that next Tuesday night it's going to happen again at 9, you can pretty much bet your bottom dollar that it's going to happen, because I'm establishing trust with you, because I am repeating a promised behavior. Now, if one night, I shouldn't say this, but for discussion purposes, I will. God forbid if one night we scheduled something for 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and I just didn't show up. So what would happen the next week? The next scheduled teleconference? Even if there were 10 previous teleconferences that I came through on, if I wasn't there for 1 week, that next time, you would be doubting again. You'd wonder again, what happened? Where was he? Is he going to come through? Later in the boot camp, I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to compare the building of a marriage to the building of a house. Because both happen one brick at a time. You've really already heard me talk about this to some extent. And every brick is significant because it strengthens the foundation of the house and of the relationship. And the stronger the foundation, particularly in the beginning, the more room you have for error once you get further up into the second and third floor. So how damaging is it to ruin one brick when you're working on the third floor of the house? It's really no big deal. You clean it up, you move on, you build on. But a damaged brick at the foundation of the house, that's a problem. It's like that in a relationship. If you have a strong foundation, then you can make a mistake without ruining everything. It's not a big deal. You can move on. But trust is different. Trust is the one exception in the dynamics of a relationship that's not like building a house. You see, everything else we've talked about, once you build up that goodwill, once you build that emotional bank account, so now you're in a more loving, safer, softer, more forgiving marital environment. So when people make mistakes, they move through it. It's okay. It's not a big deal. Trust is different. One mistake kills you, because trust is about
consistency. All it takes is one blunder and all the trust you've built up comes crashing down. You know, it's actually interesting. I'm involved now in private sessions with a couple that's really struggling, and it's been a real journey. He was in the Lone Ranger track of the boot camp, a number of months ago. I can't remember how long. And I guess every teacher, if you want to call me that, has their favorite, you know, student, so to speak. And this gentleman is really special. He really resonated with my message, and he really took everything very seriously and implemented all of the habits and worked very hard and really sought to understand the principles and apply them to his relationship. And for 5 months, he was really diligent. I mean, amazing. And prior to that, he had had an affair, and his wife asked him to leave, and she wanted nothing to do with him, and he was crawling and scratching for months and months and months trying to rebuild this relationship and get her to allow him back into her heart. And he did it. Unfortunately, very recently, he got a phone call from the woman that he had an affair with, and he made the mistake of taking the phone call. He made the further mistake of not telling his wife, even when she asked. It's a major setback. Major setback. In his mind, he just wants to move on. I've done so great the last 5 months. I've done everything. Okay, I slipped. I made one mistake. Let's move on. But for her, it's not that kind of experience, because the issue is trust. And one slip can ruin everything. And that's how trust works. It's unforgiving. It's not analogous to building a house. It's more analogous to climbing a ladder. Right, what happens when you climb a ladder? You go up one rung at a time. And if you slip on one rung, it's not like you just go down to the next rung. You slip all the way back down to the bottom. And so if you're trying to restore trust in your marriage and you're expected home by 6:15 p.m., don't walk through the door at 6:19. Because for you, that might be a matter of 4 minutes and no big deal. But for your spouse, it's about reliability. And you just slipped all the way back down to the bottom. You just broke whatever pattern of consistency you built prior to arriving home late. And now you've got to start all over again. So how do you rebuild trust? Basically, you make and keep promises. Make and keep. Over and over and over again. And don't miss. Nothing destroys trust faster than making and breaking a promise. And so to be consistent, to build trust, you need to create lots of opportunities and then come through. So create them for yourself. Honey, I'll pick up some milk before I come home, okay? And then do it. I'll be home at 7:15. Be home at 7:14. I'm going to get you some research on that stock and then have it on their desk the next day. I'll meet you at 9 a.m. Do it. I'll read it by tomorrow. Read it. I'll clean it up before I go to bed. Make sure it's spotless. I'll say it differently next time. Next time that scenario comes up, articulate yourself differently. I'll remember that when your birthday comes around. And then remember. I'll spend time with the kids tomorrow. Wake the kids up and take them out. I'll give you a break from your chores next Wednesday when I'm on vacation. Take the vacation day. Give them a break. Basically, look for opportunities to make and keep promises. Make and keep, and don't miss. That's your opportunity to build trust. Like a ladder, you climb it one rung at a time. It takes time. There's no shortcuts, and you can't slip. You've got to stay focused. And just to be clear here, the little things count big, right? I mean, if trust is about consistency, And it doesn't matter what you promise. Just promise. And just come through. And don't think that just because trust came crashing down in one dramatic event, like an affair or whatever it was, that you have to reestablish it with one dramatic event too. You can rebuild trust by making and keeping small promises over an extended period of time. So sometimes people will feel like such a failure after breaking trust with such a dramatic event that they're overwhelmed with the enormity of the task of rebuilding it. How do I ever get back there? So the first thing to realize is that you can't get back there with one dramatic event. So just wipe that possibility out of your mind and establish a paradigm of consistent behavior over time. That's how to rebuild trust. Now here's not how to do it. Okay? Here's not how to rebuild trust. First, I want to read another letter that I got to illustrate this point. Mort, counselor we used to see before we met you suggested, quote, full disclosure. Listen to this. Very interesting. That means that John has to check in with me upon my request, and I'm allowed to check his emails, his cell phone messages, and credit card bills, whatever I want. One counselor said that that would give me peace of mind, and she made John agree to give me all the access codes and passwords. What do you think about this approach? Will it help me get to trust? This is a terrible idea, and it won't work. In fact, it'll be counterproductive. Full disclosure gives you information, but information is unrelated to trust. You could be sitting right next to someone in complete awareness of their whereabouts, but still not trust them. You might not be curious about their whereabouts, but that does not mean that you trust them. Information is connected to curiosity, not trust. Do you see what I mean? You see, the irony of the advice that she just got from her counselor is that trust is not about finding comfort through information. In fact, it's about being comfortable when you don't have information. That's what trust is. I have no idea where you are or what you're doing, but I know I'm safe. You see, since the absence of information is necessary for trust to blossom, so then acquiring information actually inhibits the process. In other words, the advice from Marcy's counselor, in my opinion, interferes with the very goal she's trying to achieve. Stop checking the cell phone records. Get out of his email account. It's not helping. It may make you feel better temporarily, but it's not helping. It's also ridiculous advice from a practical perspective, I want you to know. Because no matter how hard one tries to know what's going on in their spouse's life, there's always unknowns. I mean, unless you're going to attach yourself at the hip, you just can't know everything. And so from a practical perspective, you'll never achieve comfort and trust by acquiring information. Because there'll always be unknowns that will leave you feeling uncertain. So acquiring information in an effort to build trust, it's like trying to make more money in order to be happy. It's not getting more of it that's the key. It's learning to be at peace with less of it. One final word about how to rebuild trust. And this is particularly relevant if you're not the one who breached the trust between you. In other words, if you're that woman Marcy in the email, so this is for you. I remember one day over the summer, we have a pool in our backyard, and our triplets that are 4 years old, they were learning to swim. So my son, who seemed to be picking up pretty well, he really was getting to be a good swimmer, and he would jump off from the edge and he would swim a couple of strokes to me. And then I would catch him and throw him back to the side. So he was getting so good, I thought, you know what, I'm going to back up like 5-10 steps, really far. And he said, Daddy, come closer, you're too far away.
I said, no, no, really, you are doing great. I can't believe what a good swimmer you are. Come on, you can make it. You can make it. He says, no, Daddy, come on, come closer. I'm scared. I can't swim that far, please. So I said, you are swimming beautifully. Really, you're ready to do it. Go ahead. You really think so? He thought. I'm telling you with all my heart, you can do it. I've watched you. Go. So he was a little concerned. But finally, the more I affirmed my belief in him, the more he started to believe that he could do it. And eventually pushed himself off from the side of the pool and he swam all the way to where I was standing. He made it. So what's my point? Sometimes we just need someone to believe in us in order for us to realize the potential within us. We all have the ability to be trustworthy. In the depths of our heart, even the most untrustworthy person, we really want to be a person of integrity. We want to be trusted. But sometimes we have to be given that trust first. Sometimes we need for someone to believe in us even before we believe in ourselves. And so if you've been the victim of broken trust, if this is hard, but I want you to try to look into the soul of your spouse. Try to see the seeds of greatness within them. And just give your spouse trust. I know they didn't earn it. I know it's hard. Try. Try to see the greatness within them and believe in them. Even if they don't deserve it, trust them anyway. Your faith in them will affirm their sense of worth and inspire them to meet your expectations. Somebody once told me, I think it's great wisdom, we get exactly what we expect in life. What you expect is what you get. Expect him or her to be trustworthy. Believe in your spouse, not in what you see, not in the history, but in what you don't see, but in what you know, though, is there. The great poet Goethe said, "Treat a man as he is, and he will remain as he is. Treat a man as he can and should be, and he will become as he can and should be." And this is, by the way, another reason why full disclosure is disastrous. Because you end up treating someone like they can't be trusted. Right? I mean, that's essentially what it says. Turn over your cell phone records. Give me the passwords to your email account. It's like a child. You're basically treating them like they can't be trusted, reminding them that they're not trustworthy. And that's so that you're going to get exactly what you expect. They won't be trustworthy. But if you treat your spouse like a person of the highest moral standards, then they'll be inspired to realize the greatness that you see within them.
Hi, Mort. It's Terry.
Hello, Terry.
How are you doing?
Okay, good. Thank you. How are you doing?
Good. I was wondering if you could talk about something that I know I have to work on, is expecting too much out of Chuck, or just expecting him to do things because I've been used to it, or I would do it if someone did that for me.
What was the last part, Terry? I would do it if...
Like if I did something for him, I know how I would react if somebody did it for me, but it's not necessarily the way he would react.
Right. Okay, so it's a good question. I'll maybe even give you a little bit more than you bargained for, because your question really reminds me of something else. Well, it reminds me of your situation. I mean, I've been dialoguing with you via email, and... You know, I think it's not only expectations, but I think that there's something else related to expectations that you're struggling with, and maybe this could help you. Okay. Terry's struggling with, as she said, having certain expectations of how her husband Chuck should be doing and how he should be performing and what he should be doing, and she finds herself disappointed. But not only, Terry, do I think you find yourself disappointed, but I think that when you are disappointed, when you do have these expectations, you are finding yourself challenged to stay on your task. And it's normal. In other words, it's relatively easy to be super wife when your husband is reciprocating. When he's doing all that for you, it's certainly a lot easier to be motivated and inspired to do it for him. But when
your spouse is not reciprocating, when your spouse is not doing these things, maybe because you're still on the Lone Ranger track, or maybe because your spouse is having a bad week, or maybe because they're in a slump, whatever reason, then of course it's harder for you to stay on your path, for you to continue with your work. But it shouldn't really be that way if your intention is in the right place, if you're doing what you're doing for the right reason. In other words, and this is really key, I'm going to get back to expectations, Terry, but I first want to talk about intention and purpose or goal. Because you see, when your purpose for being super wife is in order to fix the marriage, then you're anchoring your motivation on something that's not dependable. In other words, if your purpose is to fix the marriage, and that's why you're doing everything you're doing, then if you don't find the marriage fixed, if you don't find that it's working, then you're going to lose inspiration. You're going to lose motivation. You're not going to be able to do what it is that I've asked you to do and what I know you're psyched up to do consistently. Endurance and consistency and establishing these patterns of behavior as habits and lifestyle is really the key to success. These are not quick fix ideas. There is no magic pill. There is no Herculean event. There's no gift you can give or favor you can do. That's not the way we create lasting love in a successful marriage. It's a result of implementing the right habits and doing them consistently. And where do we get the motivation and the inspiration to do them consistently? Well, if your purpose for doing them consistently is to fix the marriage, well, then you're going to be demotivated and discouraged and depressed when your efforts don't have the impact that you want them to have. Because after all, you're only partly in control. Because as you're finding out, Terry, it does depend to some extent on how Chuck responds. Now, don't get me wrong. You know I'm a big believer that one person can make an enormous difference in a marriage, but they can't completely control it. There's two other partners, so to speak. Two other? Really? Which is the other, Mort? Well, one is your spouse, and the other is God. I mean, I don't mean to get religious on you, but in other words, there's fate. There's certain things that can happen, dynamics that can occur that are also affecting the quality of your marriage. And so the more your motivation and your inspiration for doing what it is that you're trying to do, Terry, hinges on fixing the marriage, or translated into your terms and the way you've put it, is the more it hinges on even less secure things, like expectations of how your spouse is going to perform, then the more discouraged you potentially could get. So what should your intention be then? Where do you draw your motivation and your inspiration? Your purpose and your intention. You should be doing these things. You should be super spouse because it's the right thing to do. Because it's your job. It's your role. It's your responsibility. It's your fixing. It's about you being the best you can be. Now that is an enduring purpose. That could never disappoint you. That could never demotivate you. Because as long as you open your eyes in the morning, that purpose stays with you. And if that's your intention, if that's your goal, to be the best Terry that you can be, to be the best wife you can be, I mean, we're all broken. We're all broken in some way. We all have got our baggage. We've all got our fixing to do. And so that's your work. That's your purpose. And it's there that you draw your motivation and your inspiration. And it's really there where you should place your expectations. And if your expectations are placed on yourself, well, then you're back in the driver's seat. I mean, you might be discouraged one day because maybe you didn't meet your own expectations, but you're not feeling hopeless and out of control Because the next morning you can wake up and say, yesterday wasn't a good day, but today I'm going to do it. Today is going to be better. Or yesterday wasn't a good day and I need to implement this system or create this discipline or fix whatever it was that was broken about yesterday. When we place expectations on other people, or when our inspiration and motivation for our work comes from outside factors, we're very vulnerable. And I think, Terry, you've been feeling that. And I feel it in your emails. I feel that you are like a roller coaster. One day is great, then the next day is not so great. And it really is not so much dependent upon what's going on inside of you as much it's depending upon what's going on outside of you. It's a very vulnerable place to be. And I don't want you to be there. I don't want you to be that vulnerable. I want you to be anchored in something that's more concrete, more secure, less volatile. And that place is your own inner strength. That place is your own inner work. And if you draw your strength, your inspirations, and have your expectations there, you're back in the driver's seat.